Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. You don't have to be a sports buff to understand the term All-American. Everything about the phrase screams winner. Even if your team doesn't make it all the way, you do. You're a star. But that didn't stop one of Ohio State's most promising players from taking the career of a lifetime and flushing it down the toilet of gambling, along with a few million dollars, much of it stolen from friends and family who amazingly stuck with Art Schleister through more than their share of his troubles. After 10 years in a variety of prisons and jails, Art Schleister is free. This time he appears to have changed course, turning his energies to writing a book, Busted, The Rise and Fall of Art Schleister, and helping others fight the demons of gambling addiction. Welcome, Art.
Thanks
for being here. How did you decide to write the book?
Well, I think over the years you develop stories and feelings about certain situations. And so many people over the years had said, Art, you need to write a book. You need to write a book. You ought to put your experiences down. And I waited for several years because, number one, I was in prison. Number two, when I got out of prison, I didn't think I was really ready. And number three, I had children and two daughters, 19 and 15, but at the time they were much younger. And I didn't know how they would handle it. And every time I broached the subject with them, they were very against it. So I decided to wait. And I finally got one of them on board and thought, well, I'll try the other one. And then the other one jumped in and said, well, okay, just as long as none of my friends read it, Dad.
Right.
And so I couldn't promise that, but I was, you know, at that point, I decided it's time to tell the story.
That's hard. It is hard on kids. Your daughters are now 16?
No, 19 and 15.
19 and 15. Okay. Is the 19-year-old, she's in college now, right?
College, yes. IU.
Okay.
She's a Hoosier.
And the, you said 15-year-old, she's a sophomore in high school then.
Yes.
There's a couple things about the book that struck me. Number one was the tone. Very conversational, very easy to read. I was telling you earlier that I even got through the football play parts, even though I really didn't know what you were talking about. But that the same was true for the gambling parts. I often didn't understand what you meant until a chapter in there where you explained all the terms about gambling. Why did you do that? It was almost like a reference chart.
Well, I think that when you write a book and you're talking about some things that people like you maybe haven't had a bunch of experiences with, you need to explain yourself a little bit. And that was the writer's idea. Jeff Snook was the writer, did a great job for me and kind of set the tone for the book from day one in the first chapter. But we just figured that we needed to give the terminology to some of it, also some statistics that people would understand how devastating and how insidious and how broad range this addiction is, and so that's why we put that part in the book.
The first couple chapters, you talk about your childhood, and you know there's no such thing as an idyllic childhood, but you know, you grew up out in a rural area. You were the star. Your parents loved you. They doted on you. They were good to all their kids. So you had strong relationships with your brother and your sister, and everything was pretty good. But it was until the end of the book that you talked about maybe some characteristics, some personality traits in you that might have been red flags at the time. Your obsession with winning, mm-hmm. At all costs and that sort of thing. How come you didn't put that in the front of the book?
Well, I think when you're describing your childhood, you know, as I look back and saw my childhood or tried to relive my childhood as I was telling the story, you know, you kind of want to keep the people in that era. And at that point, I really was unaware of exactly how all that shaped me. So as we went along, we just explained how I felt at the time, what I thought at the time, what my perceptions were at the time. And then in the end, we kind of wrapped it up by saying, hey, maybe it was, okay, you know, some of this that shaped me to be who I am today, good, bad, or indifferent. But just a look back and a perspective of how it is now compared to how it was then. And when you're telling a story, you kind of want to keep the people in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first chapter talks about being in prison in the hole and being in solitary confinement. And, you know, if I told you how I felt today about it instead of how I felt that day about it, it would have been totally different, that first chapter. So we tried to keep people in the moment. And then in the end, we kind of wrapped it up. And
I forgot about that. First chapter started out probably in one of the bleakest moments of your life.
Sure. And I think it grabbed the attention of the reader because that's really where I was at that time. And And then we kick back and start from the beginning and just talk about the processes that led up to that moment. And then after that moment at the end, we finish the story then.
The end of the book is a chapter called Self-Discovery. Mm-hmm. And through the whole process you've gone through over the last, has it been since 1978?
Yeah, it started back in 1978.
Okay. Through all those years, you obviously learned a lot about yourself, but what did you learn about yourself writing the book with Jeff Snook?
Well, I guess the toughest part was the emotional part of it, writing the book. When you're on an emotional roller coaster of a life, you really don't see how it shaped you. But for me, after I started talking about the book, I went back on that roller coaster ride again. And, that to me was the toughest part about writing the book. I don't know if that answers your question or not, but it's very emotional. When you're talking about childhood, you're talking about coaches, you're reliving memories, whether they be happy memories, sad memories, angry memories, loving memories, you kind of go back, and if you can get yourself into that place again, I think the book is better and you can express yourself better. And so that's what we tried to do. Jeff kind of had me taken back to those days and we tried to relive them.
Yeah, there is a definite tone of authenticity about it. It comes out in all the detail that you bring and a lot of honesty, a lot of tough times. And I imagine I kind of put down the book and thought, well, there's probably a lot more that didn't even get in the book.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean,
you didn't relate every gambling experience.
Well, and it would have been a 1,000-page book if I'd have done that. I think what we did was we took what we thought were the most important things, and then we built on those around the story. I couldn't tell every gambling story. I can't remember every gambling story.
You remembered an awful lot, though.
Well, I had some help from my friends who remembered it for me, too. I went back and we referenced a lot of the people that were involved in it. And so we could make sure we got the story exactly right. But for the most part, I feel like we really got most of it in.
You are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you would like to join the conversation with Art Schliester, call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What was your favorite part of the book after it was done?
Well, I can't say that I, had a lot of enjoyment in writing the book. So I think the best part of the book for me was in the end where I was able to apologize to some of the people and tell them how much I loved them and cared about them and what I felt about them, not only my family, a brother, sister, a father, mother, children. I think that was probably my most favorite part of the book, just being able to share some of the remorse that I have about what happened. And it's hard to describe that in words. And we probably didn't do a very good job of describing it in the end, but as best we could. I mean, sorry sometimes isn't good enough, but it's all you got. And your feelings about those people need to be talked about. And so I think that was my best part of it. I think Jeff really wrote the book, when he talked about, in the end, where no matter how much destruction, how much this, how much that, this is how I felt. I think being able to say that in the book meant a lot to me. But I can't say that I really enjoyed the process because it was extremely painful at times. My father was a suicide victim, had mental illness, I'm sure, to be able to do that, make that decision. And to relive that and the loneliness that not only I felt at the time that it happened, but that he must have been feeling when he actually committed suicide. I've been there before, and to go through that emotion was just very difficult.
In fact, your dad was one of the people that you said you talked to him one time and said, I want to end my life.
Well, yeah.
And he had a tough response to that.
My dad... I said, well, Dad, I just want to die. I think I'm just going to kill myself. And he said, well, why don't you just go ahead and do it then? Quit wolfing about it. you know, if you're going to do it, do it. You know, put yourself out of your own misery if that's what you want. He said, I don't think I would go that route if I were you. But yeah, pretty tough love there, or whatever he was giving me at that time.
A lot of times during the book, I had to remind myself that most of it occurred when you were very, very young. Mm-hmm. And sometimes your reactions to how you were treated by people were naive. And I had to remind myself, just because you're a gambling addict doesn't mean you're a grown-up yet.
Well,
you were very young when you started.
They say that, you know, your emotional growth stops the first time you actually make the first drink or the first bet or take the first drug. And I think for me, it was no exception. I think that I bet at an early age, just playing around with my uncles and grandparents a little bit, playing some cards. Got excited about it, enjoyed it. But the first real bet I made was when I went to the horse track when I was about 18 years old. And I wasn't very mature emotionally when I was 18.
No one
as
is.
Most people are. But I, you know, and I think that at that point I kind of stunted my growth. And to this day, I was just talking on the phone to somebody I was driving over here, and he's 51 years old, the gentleman I was talking to. And I couldn't believe, you know, that I'm saying, hey, I'm 49 years old now, and you know, it feels like I'm 18 still. And that's kind of the way the addiction takes you. You feel young in a sense, but really it's actually immaturity most of the time.
Yeah. What do you think is the most telling part? What was the part? Was it about your family? Was it the apology that was the most brutally honest?
Well, I think anytime you you dig into personal issues of how you're feeling, I think to talk about, you know, how I felt in the first chapter, you know, when you're contemplating, you know, taking your own life, taking my own life. I think that's tough to tell people, because I think it shows a weakness in a person, and a vulnerability. You know, I became vulnerable at that point. But I think sometimes you got to become vulnerable to kind of reach the next level and to be able to express yourself truly. And those were down times for me. I had some great times in life, but I also had some low times. And when you can actually be vulnerable and be comfortable with it, I think it's a growing process. It's a maturity process that I didn't really want to go through, but I did go through.
Well, most people can go through it, but they don't have to, or they don't go public with it. And so much of your down, the problems that you experienced were very publicized. And you were very young, and you weren't given, and I'm not, I don't know, would you have taken the opportunity if you had been to explain yourself? Well, I take that back. There were times when you had press conferences and said, I'm done, I'm turning over a new leaf. But that's not the same as really publicly acknowledging.
Well, everything I did was public knowledge.
Right.
You know, that was probably the toughest part. And the toughest part about recovery is, and when you become a public figure, that everything that happens is just blown up even more, good or bad. And I think part of the tough part about being a celebrity or whatever you would call
a celebrity.
What I was, I think the toughest part is kind of how you handle the really good times, because they kind of shape how you're going to handle the really bad times. And you know, and I don't think I handled the really good times very well, and as a result, when the really bad times came, I wasn't prepared for them either. So,
you are listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you'd like to join the conversation with Art Schleister, call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. We're going to take a quick break.
Good morning. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Emma Fett in for Amy Jurevich this week. It's a nice day today here in Columbus. Currently it's 71 and sunny. Expected high should be near 77. Cooler this evening. Tonight, low around 53 with partly cloudy skies. Tomorrow should be another nice day, mostly sunny and a high around 77. And Friday and the weekend also looking sunny and mild, highs near 7 in the upper 70s.
Support for WOSU comes from Integrate, helping to improve business performance through brand design and marketing communications for more than 20 years. On the web at integrateinc.com or at 614-421-0004.
WOSU Public Media and the Ethiopian Tewa Haido Social Services present the Ethiopian New Year Celebration, Saturday, September 19th, from noon to 4 p.m. at Whitehall Yearling High School. Visit ethiotss.org for more information. Now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I am talking with Art Schleister today. He fell from grace after gambling addiction took over his life. He lost his marriage, his all-star image, and 10 years of his life serving time in prison for gambling-related crimes. Gambling's like a lot of other sorts of addictions. It's not the crime itself necessarily. It's the stuff you do to feed the addiction.
Well, a lot of people ask me, Art, how could you go to prison for 10 years for gambling? It's really not illegal for the most part. I mean, there's a lot of legalized gambling. Mm-hmm. But it is. It's the things you do to create an ability to continue to gamble. And that's what happened with me, and I paid a huge price for it.
It's understandable that your addiction is gambling and not alcohol or drugs. And the idea of a gambling addiction is understandable and acceptable now, just as we understand better all the other addictions there are out there. But given some of the folks you hung around with, I sort of marveled at your resistance to even social drinking or drug use. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to have a couple beers. It's another to wake up the next morning and not remember where you've been. Mm-hmm. And you went to college in the 70s when, right. So did I. And it was everywhere, not just drugs, but alcohol, very prominent in the dormitories, the keggers and that sort of thing. How did you avoid it?
Well,
even becoming a social.
I grew up, in a family where it was preached, if you're going to be an athlete, you need to carry yourself like an athlete. You don't need to smoke. You don't need to drink. That's kind of the way I grew up. I wanted to be the best athlete I could be, so I abstained from those things. But I didn't like the taste of beer. I didn't like the taste of alcohol when I was growing up as a young kid. Certainly you have an opportunity. If your father or family's got a function and you can smell beer, taste beer, and you just, I never developed a taste for it at all. And so I never became a drinker. I didn't use drugs, wasn't looking for that kind of high. I just didn't believe in those things. And gambling gave me all those things in one. It was my high. It was my excitement. Excuse me. It was my numbing experience.
Right.
And didn't need any of those other things. But certainly in our era, as I would say, and booze and drugs were everywhere. And I just I wasn't involved in that crowd, stayed away from it, and isolated myself. And when I did isolate myself, I also isolated myself gambling too, which gave me all of those things.
You met people that you liked in college that you played football with. But I didn't get a sense that you – and they may be people you still connect with today, but I didn't get the sense that you walked away from college with a best friend from college kind of experience.
I had best friends from college, but they weren't football players.
Okay.
Doug Donnelly and I were pretty close. Wide receiver Gary Williams, Glenn Cobb, guys I played with were friends of mine. But I just never hung out with the guys too much. And that probably was – good and bad, because you hang out with a bunch of guys that are kind of wild and looking for excitement. You're going to get involved in that too. The flip side of that was when you don't hang out with your teammates a little bit, you become an enigma in a sense. And I think that's what happened with me. I think people always were wondering, why didn't Art hang out with us all the time? Now, I was loved my team and loved the teammates that I had. I just socially, I was stunted in that way, and didn't socialize with a lot of the guys on the team, and isolated myself. And then when I started gambling, of course, you're going to isolate. You don't want people to know what happened. You don't want people to know what's going on, and you only have your little circle of friends that you communicate with, and that's what happened with me.
Did folks know you gambled but didn't know you were losing so much?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it wasn't...
People knew that I loved to go to the racetrack.
Okay.
And, some of the guys on the team, we you know, we'd bet back and forth in card games and ball games and stuff like that. But, you know, I think people knew that I had a what they would call a passion for it in a sense. They didn't know it was an obsession. You know, and that was a fine line back then. You really, you know, people didn't even know the difference between a pathological gambler, a problem gambler, or just a gambler. You know, it was just you were a gambler and you liked to gamble a little bit. You know, gambling addiction is so far behind the acceptance of alcohol and drugs in the treatment process that people thought that gambling was just a choice. You know, you either did it or you didn't. You either win or you lost. And if you lost, you were a dummy. If you won, you were lucky. And, you know, there wasn't anything addicting about it. You know, Gamblers Anonymous was very small at that time. So people didn't look at me as a compulsive gambler. They just looked at me as a guy that liked to gamble.
And going to the tracks and stuff has a different aura about it. You know, the horses, the whole thing, than blackjack or the slots.
Well, I mean, you had to go to Las Vegas or Atlantic City back in the 70s and 80s to gamble. Now you can sit in your own house and get on your computer. And, you know, that's one of the problems with the addiction. It's just taken off so fast and rapidly. Into really our young kids' society now, where, you know, we've got kids 14, 15, 16, 17, 18 years old that are gambling right out of their own bedrooms, never have been to a casino, don't even know what a horse jack is, but can play poker online, they can gamble online, they can lose money online. We've had several kids attempt to commit suicide because of gambling. At a young age, had no idea that they were hooked or what happened, and they just became so depressed and despondent. So, you know, we've seen a lot of increase in the addiction process, especially in younger kids.
I was intrigued by the cast of characters in your life. More often than not, you referred to them, many of your gambling connections, as buddies.
Mm-hmm.
And Chuck Grubbs and Red Ronnie come to mind in particular. They knew what was at stake for you. Mm-hmm. They were your friends.
Right.
And yet they thought nothing of luring you out to the track. You never used that word, luring. But that's what it felt like as I was reading the book, that you were lured, that they knew you were a weak touch, a soft touch for gambling, and you'd always go with them.
I don't think I could call it luring. I think that anytime you have a desire to gamble, I think I probably lured them out to the track more than they actually lured me out to the track. But no matter where you're at or, you know, what personal things that you enjoy doing, most of the time you got a couple buddies around with you that are doing it with you. You know, whether somebody's using drugs or out drinking or gambling or eating or whatever you're doing, there's always a couple characters in the picture in everybody's life, not just in my life, you know, in your mm-hmm. life and the people that they're listening. So it's not the fact that they were luring me. I think that it was probably the opposite. I was probably encouraging them to come with me and let's do it. And, you know, there are stories that happen that, you know, when you're dealing with guys that are compulsive gamblers too, anything's possible, you know, good, bad, or indifferent. We shared a lot more bad times than we did good times as gamblers. But, you know, I give them no blame for anything that happened with me. They were probably trying to survive just as much as I was, and they enjoyed and were addicted like I was, and may never to the extent that I was. I mean, I was much more heavily involved in the addiction process.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's go to a listener right now on the phone. Vicki, you're on the air.
Yes, I look forward to reading your book. And I was wondering, when you played football in college, did your coach realize that maybe you had a problem, and did he try to help you in any way?
Well, my coach at that time was Earl Bruce, and Earl liked to go to the racetrack too, though we never went with each other. People have always talked about, you know, did you go with your coach, and did he take you out there to the track, and was he the one of the ones that was promoting gambling? And that was never really the case. Coach and I would see each other out there, you know, but no means did he try to encourage me to gamble.
But didn't it sort of validate, hey, the coach is out here, it must not be a bad thing to do?
I never thought it was a bad thing to do to start with.
Okay.
I mean, you know, perfectly harmless in a 18, 19, 20-year-old kid's mind. to go out and hang out at the racetrack. I mean, I wasn't hurting anybody at that point. And the only person that you really were hurting, if it was yourself, if it was financially or whatever it might have been, and in those early years. But he knew I liked to gamble. There was a time where he pulled me into his office and talked to me about it and asked me, excuse me, if I was okay and, you know, if I was, taking care of my own business. And I said yes. But by no means did anybody ever drag me out there. I did it my own self.
If the roles were reversed today, mm-hmm. would you see it as a red flag? Would you, I guess it's, you can't separate yourself from knowing what you know now, but in terms of the industry of the anti-gambling mm-hmm. Efforts, of the gambling addiction, the organizations out there that, like yours, yeah. by the way, that fight gambling addiction, do we know more now? Is this something a coach would want to say, hey?
I think that, yes. I think that the awareness of people who might be gambling too much or might be involved in gambling is a lot greater now than it was back when I played. Back when I went to the racetrack, Scioto Downs, Beulah Park, those tracks were very popular. It was the in thing to do. The industries have fallen, taken a plunge in popularity over the last 5, 10, 15 years. It's not the place to hang out anymore. It's not the, you know, a lot of guys used to go out on Saturday, Friday, Saturday night and go to the racetrack and enjoy it, and it would be called an activity or an event. Now it's not that way. I believe that if the roles were reversed, that yes, it would be more evident now than it was that I was a compulsive gambler. If Coach Bruce knew what he knew now about gambling and I knew what I knew now about gambling, yes, people would be talking about whether I was a compulsive gambler or not back then.
It was just an event back then. It was something you went out and did. I've never been out to the track before, but I've often wanted to. I thought it would be neat. I love horses, but I never did. Now they want to bring gambling full force into Ohio. There's one proposal out there in the governor's budget that would bring in slot machines at the racetracks.
Right.
Another is going to be on the ballot in November that would bring full-fledged casinos to the state of Ohio, to its four biggest cities. What are your thoughts about that? You didn't really get into the industry of gambling and whether you oppose that.
Well,
and your feelings about that.
And I can't really take a side on that. I mean, for me, gambling would be very devastating in the end, probably. Would I want people to gamble again? Would I want people to go test the gambling industry? No, I would say be careful. It's an addiction. It can be very addictive. You got to be very careful with it. You got to, understand that there could be a problem with it at an early age, or the first time you made a bet. But I'm not here to tell people whether they should gamble or not. The biggest thing that I believed is that if people are going to have gambling in our state, if people are going to take the responsibility of being the bookie per se for every individual in Ohio that walks through their doors, then they should take responsibility on helping treat the people that they harm. And there will be some compulsive gamblers that walk through that door. How many, no one knows. But those people are going to need help. They're going to need treatment. They're going to need understanding, from the community. They have to be some funds put aside to help those people. And if they're not willing to do that, then I don't think that any gambling should ever come to Ohio again. Our horse industry is dying. This is one way that the governor has tried to help not only the horse industry but also the economy by bringing in gambling dollars that they think is going to other states. But there's a lot of things that go into that. But first and foremost for me would be, what responsibility are those people going to take that are bringing this in there? And if it's the state of Ohio or the people that run it, what is the state of Ohio going to do to help these people that they help become addicted to this disease? It's just like responsibility when you're talking about beer and wine and booze. What kind of responsibility is the government or the state going to take to help treat the people that it hurts? And gambling's no exception. There's going to be a lot of compulsive gamblers. There's going to be an increase in crime. There's going to be an increase in divorce and family problems, because that's what gambling does to people. It's an insidious disease. It's baffling. It's powerful. It leads to insanity, prison, and possibly death. And I think that the state needs to take responsibility and help the people that it hurts. If they do that, then I think gambling's inevitably going to come into this state, and they're going to use it as a revenue source.
Can you talk a little bit about the chemistry of the gambling addiction? Because a lot of people don't understand that it's not just a feeling that you feel like you have to gamble. There's actually a chemistry involved. And when you talked in the book, you did a really good job of building up to a point where the calamity was deafening, and then you said, and then I went to numb myself, mm-hmm. which would be like you hear drinkers and drug addicts say the same thing, and it was a physical thing. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, when you're depressed and things aren't going good in your life, or there are bad things happening or things you don't want to face, people usually look for a numbing mechanism, whether it's pills, booze, drugs, food, gambling. There's all kinds of ways to numb the addiction and numb the process with an addiction. And, you know, for me, there was no exception to that. And, you know, I think the buildup is when you get depressed, when you get down and, you know, you need to address it. And gambling addicts don't. They need help to address that. For me, I just kept going and going and going. I reached a lot of bottoms. I talk about it in the book. But, you know, you always hope the bottom you reach is the lowest. But I just kept digging, you know, trying to get lower and lower and lower. And you know, and I think what I was trying to do was punish myself in the end. I lost a child in the 90s. You know, at birth, and right. I think my gambling really accelerated from 1992 to 1994 to the point where I thought I deserved to suffer and deserved to go to prison, and I continued to chase the money and continued to do things to get money to gamble with to numb the pain, and created more and more problems. I don't know if that makes sense,
yeah,
but it's an insidious thought process.
The difference between gambling, I want to get back to this, we got to take a break, but the difference between gambling and the other addictions seems to be that they will physically kill you. Alcohol can eventually kill you physically. Same with drugs. They can kill you.
Gambling can too. It just kills you in a different way.
Right.
It emotionally strips you of your dignity, your self-respect, your financial status. It ruins families. It ruins, you know, it takes and strips you of everything you've got until you've got nothing left except for, as I was, prison, insanity, and almost death. And it takes your life. It just takes it a piece at a time. And there have been thousands of suicides in our country due to compulsive gambling.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Art Schliester about his gambling addiction and about how he's resumed his life since prison. This is WOSU 820, NPR News. We'll be right back.
The new movie, The Informant, stars Matt Damon as an executive-turned whistleblower at his company, ADM. He tells the FBI about a price-fixing scheme, but he has his own secrets he's keeping from the feds. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Matt Damon and the film's director, Steven Soderbergh. They also work together on Ocean's 11, 12, and 13. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is coming up in just about 20 minutes here on WOSU 820, NPR News. It's a nice mild day today in Columbus, 73 and sunny right now. Expected high should be around 77 with a mix of sun and clouds. It'll cool down tonight to 53 degrees with partly cloudy skies. Tomorrow should look similar to today, mostly sunny and a high of 77. The nice weather should continue through this weekend, sunny and mild with highs in the upper 70s. Sign up for the Daily News Loop for updates sent right to your inbox. Get the best and trusted WOSU and NPR news and information every weekday. Sign up for it at WOSU.org.
WOSU, the Women's Fund of Central Ohio, and the Columbus Foundation present The Power of the Purse with author Farrah Warner Thursday, September 17th from 5:30 to 7 at the Columbus Foundation. More information at womensfundcentralohio.org.
Mm-hmm. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Art Schliester, the All-American quarterback who led Ohio State to two Big Ten championships and a Rose Bowl appearance. He currently manages gamblingpreventionawareness.org and speaks on the dangers of gambling addiction. You managed to sink to desperate straits with just the racetracks for a long time. What if there had been keno or slots or casino gambling back then in Ohio? What do you think? You have said in the book that that kind of stuff didn't really appeal to you.
Well, I'm not saying it didn't appeal to me. It just wasn't available. I think that any time you know, nowadays gambling is just so prevalent everywhere. I mean, you can gamble without leaving your house. You go to a horse track now, you can bet 15 or 20 or 30 tracks every day, every race. Back when I gambled, it was only, you know, 9 races a night, 5 days a week. It wasn't like it was, there was such a greater volume of it back then. There wasn't. So when you gambled then, you really had to work to gamble. You had to find a bookmaker. You had to go to the horse track if you wanted to bet casinos and those kind of things. You had to fly to Las Vegas or drive to Atlantic City. So nowadays, you can gamble anywhere, anytime, anyhow, and don't blink an eye about it. So the accessibility would have probably killed me a lot quicker. For me, it was a lot longer, slower, painful death or near death than it would have been. It would have probably been over real quick for me.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you would like to call and join the conversation, dial 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're going to take a call right now from Jen. You're on the air. Jen.
Hey, I'm just calling in as an old friend. I don't know that Art would remember me, but few people can forget Art, and I have always considered him a friend, and I'm calling to say I am so impressed by your courage, Art, and I am, it's just one voice, but I am proud of you.
Well, thank you, John. I appreciate that.
Thanks for calling, John.
My pleasure.
You said in the book that although you understand the possible chemical reaction that is taking place to cause the addiction, mm-hmm. You aren't interested in medications that might control it.
Absolutely. I think that once again, you're talking about research funds that need to be available for research to find out why people gamble, what their brain chemistry has become while gambling, the dopamine that flies through their brain. The urges and all the different things that go along with gambling, I think there needs to be much, much, much more money raised to try to figure out how you can stop this addiction. There are some medications out there that they've tried on gamblers. Some have worked, some haven't. Some work for certain people, some don't. I think it's for each gambler in recovery and trying to get into recovery, it's their decision on what they should take or how they should take it after they consult a doctor. But surely everybody's looking for a cure. I don't know if there is a cure, but there is recovery and there is abstinence, and you can arrest the disease. It's always going to be there, just like any other disease. But, it's just like getting cured of cancer. It's always a possibility. It could come back at any time. Recovering a gambler is the same way. It can come back at any time.
You go to Gamblers Anonymous meetings?
Most of the meetings that I go to are Alcoholics Anonymous meetings.
Okay.
I'm not a drinker, but I like the abstinence of AA. It's been around a lot longer. Meetings are shorter, more to the point, a lot of sobriety in them, and that's why I've attended them. That's just my choice. Now, I do attend some Gamblers Anonymous meetings, but my preference would be to look at another 12-step. An addict is really an addict. I mean, we're all in it the same way. We're looking for hope and strength from the meeting, from others. And when you go to a 12-step program, as I do, I'm no exception. I'm just one of many that's looking for support, and that's what support groups give you.
You've been doing it for a long time. You tried it early on. What's changed in that process as you see it? Has it changed styles or have you changed?
Well, I think I've changed. I mean, you know, you get sick and tired of being sick and tired, is the old saying. You know, it's the disease is always out there waiting for you. You know, you try to put one foot in front of the other foot, one day in front of with the next day, and just start building on a process. But it's I think you change. You know, you just want to have a different life. You don't want to live the same sick life all the time, and that's been the toughest part, because it's, you know, when you come out of prison and you spend so many years you know, paying for the crimes that you commit or the things that you do, you're kind of behind the eight ball to start with when you get out, and I certainly was, and that it spurs a desire to want to kill that pain. You have to learn to live with that pain, and that's what I think I've done.
You talked about earlier about how you didn't handle you probably weren't handling the your successes and the good times mm-hmm. like you should, and that affected when times got bad. How do you handle the good times now?
Well, my good times are a lot different than they used to be. You know, my good times are spending time with my children. I mean, I'm not in the glory or the limelight anymore, where I'm scoring the winning touchdown to beat Michigan or playing in the NFL or. You know, those kind of highs will never come back. And I think when you realize that and you don't search for those anymore, then I think you've got half the battle beaten. For me, in my personal battle and recovery, I think you just, you know, once you've spent a lot of time in prison, and I don't recommend that for anybody. I think prison is a warehouse for people that with no treatment available, which I think there needs to be some things done. Not only do they need to warehouse people, they need to rehabilitate them too and try to help them. I didn't see much of that while I was in prison. But it did make me appreciate, the small things, being able to spend time with my children, going out to eat with them, going to a movie with them, being called dad, hanging out, spending time with my mother and my family. You know, those are the things that you appreciate in life now much more than I did before. I coach a little football now, which I enjoy helping other kids, and you know, it means a lot more now than it used to. I used to help a lot of people and was involved in a lot of things that helped, you know, raise money for charities and all the different things that you do when you're in the limelight or you're a celebrity. But now those things just mean so much more to you. You appreciate them much more. And, you know, when you give your time or you give your effort, you know, there's the self-fulfilling feeling that you get now compared to before. It was just something that you've kind of felt like you needed to do to give back. Now I can truly enjoy it and appreciate it.
And the kids you coach down in southern Indiana, they don't know who Arch Leister is, do they?
Oh, they know very well. They Google, you know, they can Google you. You know,
I guess it's
you know, they can do all the different things that they do
right. They know
to
a
find
lot
out who
days.
You are. And they bring up a lot of it, too. But it's, you know.
So likewise, you're open about your addiction.
Very open.
Okay.
And it's fun to communicate with them because they're just, you know, kids these days have got it different. It's just a lot different. The technology in the world today has made kids become a lot different and they're raised a lot different now.
Tell me about your website and your organization. I'm searching right now for the name of it, and
GamblingPreventionAwareness.org is how you would contact our non-for-profit organization. And really what it is you know, a good friend of mine from college helped me put this together. And when I first got out of prison, and Penny Marslick is her name, she was on our board as the president of our board and has helped me tremendously with it. She and I got together and decided that, hey, maybe this would be some way that we could reach out and help others. When I got out, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. Once I did an interview or two, I realized how many people that were listening and wondered what happened, how many gamblers were out there suffering that needed help and needed direction. And so we started Gambling Prevention Awareness. And what we do is, you know, it's very simple. I mean, we're not a big conglomerate of a non-for-profit. We, you know, we don't solicit for a bunch of funds or anything like that. We have a phone number that people can call to get help all, from all over the country. That's
What's
on
that
our
number?
Website. Boy, I hate to give that out because of, I gave it out on another show the other day. I got bombarded with about 1,000 calls. 614-572-7102. It's actually a local number, but it goes all over the country. And what we do is, we take people's calls. We try to direct them into the best way to get help. Families that are suffering call us with advice. People that usually call us are people at rock bottom. You know, they need some help and they need some advice and some guidance. And we try to provide that to the gambler and their families that still suffers.
The way in the book, the way you describe how some people avoided you, it sort of reminded me after, you became the pariah. It reminded me of how some people react when they're around a person who is dying, sort of a sad aversion. I was surprised at your seeming calm when you wrote about people like your agent who said, yeah, I'll get right back with you on that. I'll check that out for you. And you never heard from him again. Mm-hmm. And there were people like that throughout your life that said, yeah, I'll be there. And you never heard from him again. Have you reconnected with any of those folks, or how did you deal with it back then? Because the book, there was sort of this sense of calm. It would be the last line in a paragraph, and I never heard from him again.
Well, I was a little surprised at that because, the agent that I had was one of the top agents in sports at the time. I think that people have their own decisions to make, and they choose either whether to be involved or not. I'm the same way in things that I'm involved in now, whether I have a decision to say whether I'm going to do this or not. Most people have kind of shied away from me in that sense. And I said in the book, I don't blame them. I mean, I just want to know who's who and where they stand. I think anybody would like to know where they stand with certain people that they're dealing with. But I have no animosity toward him or anyone else that's decided to shy away from me. I know that I've done some things that have embarrassed myself, my family, and maybe the people that supported me. And I know that it's a long process to build that back.
Something about the book, folks should know, is you name names. I mean, I don't think there's anybody's name that you don't mention that you can mention, including your daughters and your whole family, mm-hmm. and all your friends and all the folks that were friends in foible with you.
Well, I didn't talk about Johnny Salami and the Cabuzzo brothers,
okay.
Those guys.
You're right.
No,
you
I'm
did.
Just teasing them. I think we did talk about them in a little bit.
There was a little bit of that in there. But mostly you did. You named the agent who left you high and dry that time. Have you gotten any feedback from people about that sort of thing?
No. Most of the people that I talked about were well aware that I was writing a book. I try to be very respectful to most people and not only give my point of view, but probably talk about, what they were thinking at the time or why they were doing the things that they did at the time. But, when we wrote this book we weren't looking for pity or to put blame on anyone else or point fingers and say, well, you're the reason why I did this. We just want to tell the story. And I take full responsibility for everything that I did in the book, everything I've done in my life. Not happy to sometimes. I kind of wish that I hadn't done some of these things. But they're just a part of the process of life. I never would have dreamed I'd have been 10 years in prison by the time I was 49 or 109 for that matter. But I was. I went through it and came out a better person for it. Wouldn't have wanted to go through it, but I did. And it's been a learning experience.
Let's hear from Kevin. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I just wanted to say that I was one of the people that, laughed about you and, joined in on the jokes and everything. And hearing this show today has certainly changed my opinion of you. And, good luck and God bless.
Well, thank you. My favorite joke about Arch Sleester when I got in trouble was the highest paid job in the county that I lived in. Did you hear about the highest paid job in the county that Arch Sleester lives in? And they said, well, what's that? And he said, starting his car. So I thought that was a kind of a way that people would take shots at me over the course of time. But it never really got to that point too much to where I was dealing with people that, I felt like I was in fear for my life or anything. It was just a consistent push on the addiction to try to continue. And I think that over the course of time, those things catch up with you, and that's what they did with me.
Folks are popping up from time to time, you said, that are asking for money, that you owe money. Yeah. How do you keep track of all of that, and how do you even begin the restitution?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. It's I've been pretty fortunate with that. You know, I think once or twice in the last 3 years, somebody would say, "Hey, you know, you remember me? You owe me money." And one of them I didn't even remember,
yeah.
But I'm sure that I did. You know, it was broad. There was a broad range of activity in that sense. But you know, I pay restitution every month through the federal government and the state. State officials and they take a portion of whatever I make and I make an effort to pay back. If at any point where I'm able to continue to pay restitution, I will. I mean, that's the way it should be.
What's your relationship with OSU now?
I guess I really don't have any relationship with them. Besides, they do invite me to the golf outings and the captain's
that's
brunch.
Something.
And,
they didn't invite me.
And, I mean, you know, those kind of things, Ohio State, and those really aren't actually Ohio State, but just individuals that, you know, are part of Ohio State. I was a co-captain, so obviously I would get a letter to go to the captain's brunch. Even when I was in prison, I got that letter, an invitation. Some of the golf outings I'm around. Go to practice at you know, my leisure. Accepted to go to practice. Know Jim Trussell pretty well. In support of him for the most part of what he's done at Ohio State. I think he's done a great job. But you know, I haven't been voted into the Hall of Fame or anything like that. I think that they have kind of washed their hands of me in that sense, which is a tough pill to swallow at times. But I guess I understand why that is, and maybe someday that'll change.
Why didn't you cross the line to gamble on your own team? We don't have a lot of time left, but I wondered about that. What is it? What's the issue there
for you? I grew up, you know, it's kind of like not drinking and not smoking because you're an athlete. The other part of not athlete, why would you ever, I was a pure believer in winning and losing, you know, that you played your best to win and you gave it your all for your team. And I always played that way. You know, the gambling was separate in that sense. There wasn't a time where I ever mixed it and said, well, this is the only way I can get out. I need to do this or do that to you know, and it won't be too bad. But, you know, I never crossed that line. Never will, never did, never thought about it. Never, you know, when I was approached about it, I quickly talked to the proper people about it when I was in college. And that was that. I just I brought up to that the game was pure. And even though I'm a sick addict and I do gamble when I'm not on the field, I would never gamble while I played on the field.
This is All Sides with Dan Fisher. I've been talking with Art Schliester. He has written a new book. It is called Busted, The Rise and Fall of Art Schliester. And he's also helping others fight the demons of gambling addiction. What's the email address?
Gamblingpreventionawareness.org.
Gamblingpreventionawareness.org. Thanks for joining us today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. WOSU 820 NPR News.